You're listening to The Profile.
Hi, and welcome to The Profile podcast. I'm Andy Peck. For the last 19 years, it's been my joy to investigate how Christians can lead better by talking to a variety of Christian leaders inside and outside the Christian world. So whether you are in a leadership role or simply looking to maximize your influence for God, I hope you find this next conversation helpful. The show is brought to you by Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. Get full online access and the print magazine every month by becoming a subscriber. See special offers available now at premierchristianity.com. I wonder what qualifications you have to lead. You might be able to point to professional qualifications, to academic qualifications, maybe to an MBA. But I wonder if you could choose to point to the tough times in your life. What can be called the crucibles of leadership, when in the red hot heat of the battle, your reactions at the time and on reflection build character within you. Well, someone who has reflected long and hard about this topic is my guest today. Gail Beebe is the president of Westmont College, a Christian liberal arts college in Santa Barbara, California. And he's written a book, The Crucibles That Shape Us, Navigating the Defining Challenges of Leadership. He's also the author of The Shaping of an Effective Leader and the co-author of Longing for God with Richard J. Foster. In this latest book, he looks at seven defining crucibles and, using examples of leaders past and present and his own journey, outlines how we might face these particular areas and God helping us become better leaders as a result. So great to have you on the show, Gail.
Andy, thank you for having me. And it's really, it's wonderful to meet you and to be able to join you this morning.
I didn't list the seven areas, so we'll look at that in a little while. But the book starts with stories from some of the challenges you faced at Westmont College, and they were an astonishing, tumultuous time that you faced. And I just wonder whether that was the backdrop for you focusing on this book.
Well, that is such a great question. I've got to tell you a fun story. So a dear friend of the college was at one of our conferences, and he looked at me and he goes, "You know, a lot of bad things have happened since you got here." And he paused and he goes, "You know, that came out wrong. A lot of bad things have happened. How do you think about them? And have you thought about writing about them?" And I said, "You know, I actually had just started thinking about them and writing about them, and had made a couple of presentations where I kind of test drove the ideas with presidents' groups that kind of face, you know, a variety of challenges. You plan for things and then you have surprises." And so it was out of that that I really began to reflect on these natural disasters, but then also ones that reminded me of periods of my own wrestling with the problem of evil and suffering, some hardship in my own life, some loss in my own life, as well as just what we went through as a result of wildfires that are a part of the chaparral of California, the debris flow, which was a unique episodic event that happened here because the ground had just been fired like clay in a kiln, and the mountain came apart, and the mountains that are up above campus were just 2 miles from the ocean. So it's just a gorgeous setting, the ocean in front of you, the mountains behind you. But the mountains came apart and it was a huge rainstorm. The boulders broke loose. You had, they estimated anywhere from 8 to 10 ton boulders, literally caroming down the hillside, crushing homes, cars, anything in its wake. It destroyed 100 homes, critically damaged 400 others, and killed 23 people. And as I mentioned in the book, within a 30-day period, I attended 7 memorial services for people that I knew or had worked very closely with. And it was just a devastating period. And so it was the fire in December of 2017. We had to evacuate campus early as students were preparing for finals. We had just come back and literally started spring semester on January 8th. In the early morning hours of January 9th is when the debris flow happened. And it literally was just staggering the way that it wiped out the infrastructure in our area of Santa Barbara. But it was out of that that we began to really reflect on the many ways in which communities come together as a result of grief and suffering, and also the ways in which individuals grow. You either grow or you're destroyed when you go through experiences like that. And then it rolled into the global pandemic, and it coincided with the race conversation exploding in America, and particularly hitting a real feverish point on the Memorial Day murder of George Floyd. And so some of the other chapters in the book are, you start in one place, and then you begin to recognize that these spiritual principles and life learnings and lessons actually prepare you for other experiences, and you really do grow in your a deeper life with God. It leads to, I think, a richer internal conversation. And I think one of the challenges for leadership is to develop an internal conversation that leads to self-correction. And I think these crucible moments are places where we both respond to them, learn how to respond to them, but also grow in our capacity to absorb other blows that are sure to come as you go forward in life.
Well, thank you, Gil. Just this, perhaps, just list the seven for us.
Bet.
It'll be just handy to, so that we're confident what we're talking about, and then maybe we'll focus on one or two that perhaps have particularly.
Yeah, I opened the book with the crucible of missed meaning. And this is really playing off the fact that so often we end up in situations and we actually don't know how to see them. And so we make mistakes because we actually don't understand what's at play or what the bigger realities are. And I talk about our cycle of global learning, where we send students overseas, not just to have experiences, but to actually capture meaning. There's a wonderful line in T.S. Eliot's poem, The Four Quartets, where he said, they had the experience, but they missed the meaning. And I think that that is so often true, both of life and especially of leadership, that you have experiences, but you miss the meaning. And you miss the moments and opportunities to actually learn and grow so that you do your work better. Second one is the crucible of enduring challenge. And I went to Winston Churchill High School in Eugene, Oregon. And so I am a great lover of Winston Churchill. And I had a wonderful English teacher, Miss Brunken, who would give you extra credit if you could match what Churchill said and to whom he said it. And you would get 10 extra points on every test. And I loved it. What it did is it gave us this total love for Churchill's sense of humor, how quick he was on his feet. And so I quote some of my favorites, including the one where he's supposedly campaigning. Man, he asks a man for his vote. The man says, vote for you. Well, I wouldn't vote for the devil, to which Churchill responds, well, in case your friend isn't running, can I count on your support? Well, who thinks that quickly on their feet? I mean, it's just amazing. But then I look at Henry Kissinger and Kissinger's last book, his book called Leadership. And it actually came out on his 100th birthday. He would die a few months later. But it's just a brilliant treatment of six world leaders that he worked with, or in the case of Richard Nixon, worked for. And Kissinger just elevates leadership principles that each of these individuals manifested, including Margaret Thatcher. His last personality is Margaret Thatcher, who would also have great interest for the British public. And he, in every case, he demonstrates the way in which they would just get in situations where their ability to endure was the most remarkable part of their leadership during these periods, and to stay to their principles and to really see things through. The third one is the crucible of human treachery. And Andy, what's been interesting to me in the early days of the release of the book, the two chapters that have gotten the most interest and I've had the most inquiries about are chapter 3, the crucible of human treachery, and chapter 6, the crucible of human suffering. And what I'm trying to deal with in human treachery is, when is it basically you just lack character? And I try to compare Peter and Judas by saying, Peter, it was just really, he didn't have the strength of character to identify with Christ. In the case of Judas was out to destroy Christ. And it was an active, malicious experience of human treachery. I think we actually experience both. And unfortunately, I think in the Christian church and even among Christian leaders who run some of our great organizations, they, part of their life development has been these experiences of betrayal and how they've made their peace with them, how they've come back from them. And also it's just a cautionary tone to recognize that any human organization is run by people just like you and me. And although we don't think we would ever pull a Peter, and God forbid we ever pull a Judas, basically what scripture teaches us and what life experience teaches us is we're all capable and we're all vulnerable, and we could do the same thing if we're not careful. The fourth one is the crucible of awakened moral conscience, and this is where I look at the life of Martin Luther King Jr. I was raised in the evangelical Quaker tradition, and so his nonviolent civil disobedience was very much a respected value within the French church in America. And King was one of these figures who he did not give up his belief in the power of Christ and in the power of the gospel, and his view that love begets love and hate begets hate, and violence doesn't solve problems, it perpetuates problems. And just so many ways in which he had this amazing capacity to see into the reality of things and provide, pardon me, an alternative example as the civil rights movement swept through the United States. The fifth one is the crucible of social conflict. And I actually pick as my person there John Lewis, King's understudy. And people have often said that King would have become violent if he would have lived and not been assassinated when he was 39. But I think John Lewis is our best sense of what King would have been like, who lived to 80, died of pancreatic cancer, a very short bout of cancer. But Lewis never gave up the principles of nonviolence and really tied his political message to the love of Christ made present in the world. And I think there's just so many examples from these periods where how do you deal with serious and aggressive opposition and even hatred? You deal with it through the love of Christ. Then, as I mentioned, chapter 6 is the crucible of human suffering. And this is very much tied to my own journey, where really coming to a full wealth of conviction, my Christian faith was a result of my favorite pastor dying tragically at age 32. Mount Hood is the highest mountain in Oregon. He was up on Mount Hood, had a fatal accident, killed him, left a wife and four children, ages 10 down to 16 months. And I was in my first semester at Princeton Seminary preparing to become a minister. My thesis advisor, Diogenes Allen, I had never met him, but I was encouraged to meet him, and we hit it off. I mean, he was a Rhodes Scholar. He actually married his wife, Jane, was British. They had met at Oxford when he was on his Rhodes Scholarship. But he was so helpful at helping me think through the problem of evil and suffering so I could make my peace with Don's death. 7 years later, my own dad would die of a heart attack at age 60. And although it was emotionally devastating, it didn't disorient me spiritually, which I found quite interesting, that Don's death had really been a crisis of faith. My dad's death, not at all. And that's when I began to recognize that the way in which you respond to experiences of suffering, if you can make sense of them, if you can build plausibility structures to help explain them, they help prepare you for later experiences of grief that comes from experiences of suffering. And they don't disorient you from the Christian faith. In fact, they deepen it. My wife is a grief recovery counselor, and I've learned so much from her in terms of how people actually heal. And we often see suffering as a barrier to belief in God, when in fact, it's a passageway. And over again, my wife, Pam, has been a part of people healing from these horrible experiences. And in the process, actually coming into faith for the first time, or deepening their faith if they're already followers of Christ. And then the last crucible is the crucible of personal choice. And like it or not, often many of the problems that we face in life are ones of our own choosing. And so I work through that. One of my favorite thinkers in this arena is Daniel Kahneman, the famous cognitive and social psychologist who actually just passed away earlier this spring. Just his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, kind of distilled in popular form the work that he and his late collaborator, Amos Tversky, for which they won the Nobel Prize in economics, of all things, as cognitive psychologists. But we're in that, I'm just really looking at how do choices influence and shape us, and how can we make better choices, and how can we understand the way in which bias often causes us to make choices that aren't in our best interest or in the public good.
Oh, that's a really helpful summary. Thank you so much, Gail. Inevitably, when an author puts a book together and does their research, they learn some things, or their interest become more interested in others. What, in terms of your journey of learning, what were the particular highlights for you?
Yes, that's such a great question. And the question floods my mind. I think the most interesting one for me was, although I had grown up always aware of Martin Luther King, and I had a lot of information and had read generally, but when I started that chapter, I knew I wanted to write, but I didn't realize how much I didn't know. And so I started reading, and I realized, well, oh man, I've never even thought of that. And then I'd read more. And it actually took me an entire year to write chapter 4. I worked on the book. The book took 4 years to write, and chapter 4 took 1 year of it. Now, I'm a president, so I had other things that were my first responsibility. But in terms of my discretionary time and reading, and that really surprised me. But it also just deepened my love and appreciation for MLK and kind of his enduring example, where I no longer see him as just a great thinker on race relations. I see him as a great thinker on human relations and really coming up with strategies that have enduring reality. I loved writing Enduring Challenge because I do believe so much of my effectiveness in life and so much of effectiveness generally is tied to being willing to persevere. And I love Churchill. I know he's a controversial figure, but I really appreciate Henry Kissinger. And so just loved getting to work in that. The human treachery and human suffering were very near to me, having experienced both. And they both make you aware of how do you come alongside people who have gone through that. And one of my favorite pastors, now contemporary pastors, and has gone through an experience of human treachery. And being able to walk through him as he comes to terms with just feeling like people who are supposed to be in his corner just totally abandoned him, has just given me a deeper appreciation for how the disciples recovered following the betrayal of Christ to actually build the early church. And that's quite remarkable. And then human suffering, that is so close to my own life. And from Dr. Allen, Diogenes Allen was my thesis advisor at Princeton. I really came to a full wealth of conviction because of his guidance when I had this really just disorienting experience of evil and suffering. And I've just been forever grateful for that and want to be available to people who go through similar experiences, because there is life on the other side of it. There is growth and understanding. And quite frankly, we've always viewed suffering as somehow an interruption to life, when in fact, God and scripture itself teaches us that it's a part of life. And it's not how do you avoid suffering, but how do you find the deeper life with God as a result of your suffering? And that's when I really recognized that it was a passageway and not a barrier.
Gail, the people listening to this show will be Christians in leadership. They'll lead in all sorts of realms, but many will be church leaders. And I'm just wondering which of the crucibles might be ones where, I mean, our hope is that people grow in character, but some actually don't, and people leave because of the crucible. They, you know, they think, like, if that's what it's going to be like, I'm going to leave. I'm just wondering which of the crucibles might be toughest for someone in church leadership, particularly.
Well, the place I would turn is actually, oddly enough, maybe it'll seem odd, is chapter 2, The Crucible of Enduring Challenge. And I don't know if you had a chance to read it, but so I was working with Cindy Bunch, who is the senior, she's the senior vice president, acquisitions editor at IVP. And I love working with Cindy. She's just terrific. She's a terrific person and just very skilled. But she said, okay, I want you to make, I read chapter 2. I want a list. Give me a list of what you actually think about when you're in these different situations and scenarios. And so I wrote a list of 12. And do you mind if I just read?
No, please do. Quickly? Yeah.
So this is on page 28. And the reason I share these is this is closest to my, I started out in pastoral ministry, then migrated into higher ed. And so these really pertain to pastors and leaders of faith-based organizations. Number one, enjoy today. Tomorrow has enough worries of its own. You can hear echoes of the Sermon on the Mount in that.
Yep.
Number two, never open a two-front war if you can help it. Number three, don't overreact to overreactions. Number four, don't say everything you think. I've never gotten in trouble for things I thought but didn't say. Number five, stay emotionally present even when you don't feel like it. Number six, I've never had an opportunity to expand without a potential problem expanding with it. Number seven, be disciplined with what you share and with whom you share it. I mean, be cautious. Number eight, avoid no-win arguments. This is from my father. It's like wrestling with a pig. You both get dirty and the pig loves it. My father grew up on a farm. Number nine, cultivate a results-oriented mindset with attention to doing the right activities. My MBA, I did a dual degree at Claremont, and Peter Drucker was the head of our MBA program.
Right, yeah.
And he said, never mistake activity for results. But you have to recognize that you have to do the right activities to get the right results. So it really includes both. Number 10, cultivate an inspiring edge that stimulates hope and renewal. Number 11, maintain a commitment to open communication and conflict resolution. And then number 12, and this comes to some of the heart of your question, always work to outlast the opposition, except when you know it's the right time to leave for the right reason. I think this is where both pastors and leaders of faith-based organizations sometimes give up too soon. And I would say, be sure that you're not doing harm to the organization by leaving too early. You can overstay, and you can do harm when it becomes your ego in conflict with your elders or your board. But so often people hit the eject button early, and yes, they get to a better place, but the organization just collapses or takes a severe blow and takes several years to recover. And you really have to balance both competing commitments. Part of your responsibility or your stewardship as a leader is not just during the time that you're in the seat, but how do you hand it off for the next generation of leadership that will follow you? One of the greatest joys for me is serving purposes of God that will outlive me. And one of the things I love about being at Westmont is this is an institution that honors God, provides just a robust, first-rate education in every area of human learning, but it also gives you an opportunity to deepen your life with God. And so I love the fact that long after I'm gone, long after my life on earth is over, Westmont will continue. And part of the joy for me is serving God's purposes through its work.
Wonderful. Gail, what would you hope the book will achieve? What's the... in your heart of hearts?
More than anything, I hope it encourages people. I just have a tremendous sense of gratitude for the people that have poured into my life. My earlier leadership book on the shaping of an effective leader, part of it was written to thank Dr. Drucker for his influence on my life, but it also features a mentor in every chapter from whom I actually learned the principle. And I hope this book has that similar effect. It's easy to get discouraged in our work, not only in Britain, but even in America, which has a high interest in religious activity. It's a period of real shaking out. And many pastors are discouraged. Many leaders of faith-based organizations are discouraged. And I hope my book can come alongside people and encourage them in their work, help them feel valued, and hopefully point them to ways in which they can resolve questions or at least resolve them enough to continue on. When I was studying at Princeton, Dr. Allen introduced me to Blaise Pascal. The Pensées became my favorite work and continue to be my favorite work today. And one of the things that Pascal talks about is the way in which we create habits that often keep us from knowing or loving God. And what we need to do is create habits that actually incline our heart to God. And I hope the book helps incline our heart to God.
It's a great, great aim. And the discussion questions at the end of every chapter, so you could read it with other leaders and a church leadership team or whatever.
Well, and this has really been fun because even people that I barely know or don't know at all have told me that they're using it in their home groups. Home group ministry is a big strategy within evangelical churches in North America. And so that has been very meaningful to me. Cindy was the one who really encouraged me to add the questions at the end of the of each chapter and to invite people to discuss the work. And it's just meaningful to find out it's being really used already.
That's fabulous. Well, thank you so much for your time today and for sharing your story and the story of Westmont, but also for this book. So thank you so much.
Oh, you bet. Andy, great to be with you.
That was my conversation with Gail Beebe, The Crucibles That Shape Us, Navigating the Defining Challenges of Leadership by IVP. If you're wondering about his spelling of his name, Gail is G-A-Y-L-E and Beebe, B-E-E-B-E. It's always salutary to talk about tough times, but as Gail said, these times which threaten to knock us out can be the making of us if we allow them to. So maybe this show finds you in one of those tough times, and I hope you are heartened by his reminder to keep going, perhaps for the sake of those you serve, even if it's not your preference, as of course you look to God for comfort and support and seek out other Christians to share with. It just seemed appropriate as we close to reflect upon the writings of Paul in 2 Corinthians 4. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen, since what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. So may God help us as we see him at work within us, even as outwardly challenges are being faced. This is Andy Peck, your host, thanking you for your company and looking forward to the next time.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.